You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours,
welcome,
and not
to the Heartland Labor
Forum, those of KKFI or any unions involved.
And welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I am Jen Zaman. I am in for Judy Ansel, who is on vacation. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the International Association of Machinists, Local 778, and Teamsters Joint Council 56. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers of Local Lodge 778 in Kansas City, Missouri, represents thousands of working class people in and around the metro. Our members work in a variety of industries, including automotive, manufacturing, freight, and logistics and public works. We proudly support the Heartland Labor Forum as it continues to educate our friends and neighbors about the issues affecting Missouri's working class families. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for all their support. On tonight's show, could community schools be an answer to cash-strapped school districts? Hear education activists describe and define community schools on tonight's show. It's a perfect topic for community radio. In the news, Amazon workers in Minnesota continue their protests. The number and rate of job injuries that killed workers both declined by 1% in 2017, but there's a long way to go. Corporations giving bonuses to workers falls dramatically in 2018. And Weston Book Cadillac workers in Detroit win their union's biggest ever wage increase. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. And now for the news.
The news from our side, December 20th, 2018. Amazon warehouse workers in Minnesota protested to improve their working conditions and were joined by several notable politicians. According to the technological website Gizmodo, joining the group of protesters outside of MSP1 was Representative-elect Ayan Omar, the first Somali-American representative in the U.S. Congress. Amazon doesn't work if you don't work, she said to wild cheers, and it's about time we make Amazon understand that. Minnesota Lieutenant Governor-elect Peggy Flanagan also passed on words of encouragement to workers through an unlisted video on the Governor-elect's YouTube channel, stating, "Today, my hope for you is that you can organize in partnership to create jobs at Amazon that are fair, safe, and reliable." She stressed the importance of collective bargaining, something that Amazon has widely been viewed as hostile toward since Gizmodo obtained an internal anti-union training video in September. Just before 5 p.m., the crowd of protesters moved from the sidewalk in front of MSP1, where they had a massive prayer rug as well as an amplification system from the bed of a pickup truck and marched on the building itself. Police officers, who had not been present earlier in the day, lay in wait in the parking lot and were joined by additional units, including the Minnesota State Patrol officers and Scott County Sheriff, approximately 16 vehicles in total. The Shakopee Police Department confirmed in a phone call with Gizmodo, no arrests, no property damage, no injuries. In the moment, officers seemed confused as to which individuals were protesters and which were simply leaving work. The crowd, meanwhile, dispersed peacefully, chanting, "Amazon, we will be back."
PAI reports that the number and the rate of job injuries that killed workers both declined by 1% in 2017 compared to the year before. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reported some 5,147 workers died that year, a Bureau of Labor Statistics survey calculated, or 3.5 per 100,000 workers. But don't tell that to truckers, construction workers, or workers in Alaska, the Dakotas, Wyoming, Louisiana, Mississippi, or at least in sheer numbers, New York City. All these states led the nation in a rate of number of workers killed by job injuries per 1,000 workers last year. Alaska and North Dakota tied in the state fatality rates with 10.1 dead workers per 100,000. New York City was far safer with only 2.3 workers per 100,000 killed in 2017, but the absolute number of deaths there rose from 56 in 2016 to 87 in 2017. And don't tell the nation's truckers or construction workers. Trucking set a new record with 599 deaths from on-the-job injuries, up from 570 the year before. Their 2017 death rate was 28 deaths per 100,000 drivers. Some 747 construction workers died on the job last year, more than any other occupation, and up from 736 in 2016. Don't tell Peg Seminario, the veteran director of the AFL-CIO's Occupational Safety and Health Department, that the report had much good news either. Most of the deaths from on-the-job injuries were preventable, caused by well-recognized hazards, which employers, with little effort, could have avoided, she said. There was a small decline in the number and rate of job deaths. 5,147 workers lost their lives on the job, she said, down from 5,190. But that is an average of 14 workers dying each and every day. This does not include the deaths from occupational diseases like black lung and silicosis, which are on the rise. Today's sobering report comes at a time when the number of Occupational Safety and Health Administration inspectors is at its lowest point in decades, and the Mine Safety and Health Administration inspection force has dwindled, she added. Instead of increasing life-saving measures aimed at protecting workers at their workplaces, the Trump administration is rolling back existing safety and health rules and has failed to move forward on any new safety and health protections. And while Seminario didn't say so, the GOP Trump administration's Mine Safety and Health Act has looked the other way so much at one malefactor coal mine that the mine workers have been forced to take the owner and the Mine Safety and Health Act to court. Stopping these rollbacks, strengthening job safety protections, and preventing unnecessary worker deaths, injuries, and diseases must be the top priority of the new Congress, she declared.
Deaths from falls reached record high levels, 887, Seminario added. Deaths from confined spaces, 166, increased by 15%. Deaths among Latino workers, 903, increased after declining in 2016. Job deaths also increased in mining, oil, and gas extraction.
And the news tonight was read by Michael Savoir and Chris Mann. And now for community schools. Enjoy.
My name is G.T. Brown, from Chicago, Illinois. Honored, proud son of the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization and National Director of the Journey for Justice Alliance. We are a network of grassroots community-based organizations. I'm happy to report now in 31 cities across the United States. Committed to community-driven school improvement. We believe that community wisdom in partnership with academic expertise leads to school improvement. In 1954, the Supreme Court passed a landmark piece of litigation called Brown v. Board that said that separate but equal must end with all deliberate speed. As a result, unfortunately, of decision makers resisting that mandate, so much so that Senator Harry Byrd from Virginia called for massive resistance to Brown v. Board. And actually, parents who happened to be white across the country began to pull their children out of the public school system to avoid sharing resources and opportunities with children of color. We know that the mandate of Brown v. Board has never been realized. So much so that in the 1990s, unfortunately, our government began to initiate something called zero tolerance. And instead of looking at our children through a lens of love and care, looked at our children through a lens of judgment and hate. And if you reflect on it, it's actually ruined the lives of millions of young people. So instead of making sure that we funded Title I correctly, instead of making sure that we funded IDEA, instead of making sure that we had equity finally in public education, that all children, regardless of who God made you or regardless of your zip code, have access to quality education, we demonized those children that we neglected on purpose.
Come on,
And as zero tolerance purged school systems of young children of color, who only needed a counselor to talk to figure out how do I walk my little brother to school and walk through a gang-infested territory. Yes, I get to school late every day, but I get to school. Instead of dealing with the fact that there are drugs in my neighborhood, there are gangs in my neighborhood, I'm 9 years old and I'm seeing two people murdered. How do I deal with this? Instead of making sure those children had counseling and support, demonize those children, what happened next? It's so sad, it's almost funny. What happened next is there was a decision to privatize public education. If we walk back, we remember there was a time when white abolitionists and African Americans from the African Methodist Episcopal Church locked arms and formed the African Free Schools in Philadelphia and New York, bonded by a mission to make sure that all children, regardless of how they look or where they come from, will have access to a world-class education.
That's right.
Regardless of that fact. We were given the illusion of school choice. But as organized parents around the country, as we saw our schools close, but still being cheated out of billions of dollars, as we saw teachers purged out of public school systems, replaced by new inexperienced teachers. We began to realize, and I've said this before, that as a parent, I have a lot more in common with a teacher than a hedge fund. I have a lot more in common with Randy Weingarten than I do with Bloomberg. So we may not agree on everything, and that's okay, but what we do agree on is that public education is worth saving. What we agree on is there are models that work. Why is the model in Cincinnati, Ohio not being replicated across the country? Because we know that community wisdom and academic academic expertise lead to school improvement, why are we ignoring the voices of those directly impacted? Why are we saying it's all for the kids, but we don't want to listen to their parents? That is a heightened contradiction that we no longer accept.
That's right.
School choice is a scam.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Now I want you to repeat it. School choice is a scam. It's the shell game.
It's the shell game.
It's three card Monte. It's pick a card, any card. But we demand equity, not the scam of school choice. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Chris Mann, and I'm very excited to host this particular show. The introductory speech you've just heard was from a rally which took place in Cincinnati, Ohio on October 29, 2018. G2 Brown, National Chair of Journey for Justice, was the speaker. Our topic tonight is community schools. What are they? How can they help any community? And how do people get community schools in their cities? Our guests tonight are Kyle Cerrete, National Education Association Teacher, Education Association Representative, and he's in the Teacher Quality Department. And we have Ann Pritchett, longtime education activist and now retired teacher from Kansas City Public Schools. Welcome to both of you. Perhaps both of you could give a minute or two, some words about your background and experience, what made you want to work for public education.
20 years ago, I was a chemistry teacher, but my work in public education centers around my belief that a great education is the pathway towards letting the dreams that you had when you were just a little kid become true. The work that I'm engaged in is to make it so any school will provide the opportunities to students and families and communities to be able to allow children to achieve what they want, which I know sounds totally idealistic, but there are places around the country that have made it so zip code is not a determinant of the pathway that your life will lead. And just because we have 14,000 school districts in 50 states, we can learn from some that have accomplished this, and we can use our own responsibility to scale it so that those islands of excellence aren't islands anymore, but they're more concentrated.
Anne?
I wanted to work in education because it was just a lifelong goal. I felt like it was my calling. But then I was fortunate enough to work in a community school, and so I was able to see firsthand what kind of a difference it makes for the kids.
For me, being a teacher and a public education advocate, I traveled to Chicago to catch a chartered bus, go to Cincinnati, Ohio. This was sponsored by the Kenwood Oakland Community Center. The purpose of the bus tour was to see community schools in Cincinnati, Ohio. The Chicago Teachers Union, in conjunction with education and community activists, bargained into their last contract to transform 20 Chicago public schools into community schools. Parents, principals, and teachers were on the bus to Cincinnati. Once in Cincinnati, we toured two schools and attended a press conference featuring G2 Brown, Randy Weingarten, my national union president, and Education Coalition activists from Cincinnati. From the tour, I learned that it is possible to put resources where they need to be via sustainable community schools. This is what we are here to describe and define tonight. In light of budget crisis in public education, we might consider similar options for Kansas City area public schools. Kyle, how would you define a sustainable community school? Is that a school that has specific components, and why is sustainable in the title?
If you ask the average person what a community school is, they think that you're just saying neighborhood school. And they're not, for folks who aren't aware of the idea of community schools, is a longtime practice that was started in the late 1800s. By Jane Addams and put forward by John Dewey later on and into the schoolhouse. But in general, a community school is a school that has hires a person to be their full-time community school coordinator or community school manager or director, and they lead a process with stakeholders, and let's just define stakeholders as students, families, and staff of the school and the community around the school, in a process to learn what are their assets, what are their dreams, what's their vision for their school, and then what do we need to do to achieve that? So they don't guess about what the needs are and what the vision is for stakeholders. What they do is they spend a lot of time trying to figure out what those things are, and then they get addicted to problem solving, and they solve those things. And sometimes the problems that are solved are problems that you can fix by painting the building or remodeling your curriculum. So if you have 99% Black and Brown students, that you see Black and Brown people in your textbooks. But a lot of the partnerships also come outside of the school. So if you go to Cincinnati, as you mentioned, and you go to the Euler School, which you might have visited, you'll see a full-time dental clinic and an eye clinic and a full suite of mental health support and a full-time tutoring practice. And so what you should get out of that is not the fact that community schools is this thing that has dental clinics and mental health. What you should get out of it is that the best community schools figure out what they need and they put those things in. So if you go to another community that wasn't Euler, which is a community in Lower Price Hill in Cincinnati, but you went to a different neighborhood, it might look like something totally different. It might be a robotics club partnership, a partnership with the YMCA to do basketball, et cetera. So community schools help dreams become possible by removing barriers, but also by remodeling what's happening in schools so it's even better than what it's happening. And it's not just for maybe mine, you're picturing the poorest communities and the poorest schools. Every school can be a community school. And the reason why we call it sustainable is because when you do such a time-intensive, deep effort to understand the vision and the dreams of a community, and you then make those dreams become possible, then what happens typically in the education space, where this great idea comes in and then it's gone in 2 or 3 years, and then another great idea comes in, community schools that are sustainable or sustainable community schools are sustained because they're anchored by the stakeholders that have dreamt it up. I mentioned earlier that you do need to have a person who's leading this effort, because it's unfair to ask someone who already is an educator or a custodian or a parent who has a full-time job or a principal. They already have jobs. This is a full-time effort to accomplish this. So the best practices are to hire someone who will lead the process, but they're just leading a process to help you find your articulate your dreams and help make them a reality.
So that person would have to be sort of a troubleshooter and also be highly bought into the concept.
Yeah, so this person, there's basically there's a few different models of community schools that you find out there, but if you kind of draw a line through them, this is a person who is not daunted by a problem, but they're actually inspired by it. And you should just know that this person is not the person who solves the problem. This is a person who leads stakeholders through a process of trying to solve the problem and knowing that you're probably going to get it wrong and then get it wrong and get it wrong until you get it right.
Okay.
So that's what this person is.
Yeah. So I'd like to switch now to Ann. Ann was a teacher in what we think is our closest thing to a community school environment. So, Ann, how did you feel working in a more community school environment?
Well, it was wonderful. We had a dental clinic, as you mentioned. We didn't have the eye clinic, But that does sound like a pretty good idea. And looking back on how we put it all together, I think that would be a lot less expensive. The community or the dental clinic was really expensive. My school had a full-time nurse practitioner, and she had an assistant. And then we had a dental clinic, and we had a full-time social worker and a full-time truancy officer. But what made this work so well was all of the community partnerships. The social worker was paid by one agency. The nurse and the dentist were paid by another agency. The truancy officers, the money for that program came from the juvenile detention facility in the county, and they all came together. And then we also had outreach workers, and pretty much every agency in that part of Kansas City had a full-time employee in our building. I worked there for 13 years, and the end result, we started this in the mid-90s, right before No Child Left Behind. And so when we started testing, our test scores, we had the best test scores of any elementary school in the district, and we were also the only school in the district that met AYP annual yearly goals every single year. And we really felt like it was because the needs of our kids were being met by other than the teaching staff. It was wonderful. We could all teach every day. If I had a kid come in who didn't feel good, I could send him directly to the nurse. She was a nurse practitioner. She could write a prescription, and she got to make the decision whether the child needed to go home or not. I had other kids. The social worker's office was right across the hall from my classroom, and I had so many kids who came in every day wanting to talk to him that he just would stand in the hall and greet my students with me. I was a self-contained special education student, so his services were greatly appreciated by my department and by my students and their parents. And it got to the point too with the special education students is that other parents in the district were requesting placement in our school because they'd heard such wonderful things about the program. And then my school also, we won the State of Missouri awards 15 schools every year, and they call them Gold Star schools. The application process is really intense, and we were named a Gold Star school 1 year, and there's only been 3 schools in the Kansas City, Missouri school district who've ever achieved that status. And that is the what you have to have in order to be a blue ribbon school recognized by the federal government. So I felt like it was very successful.
Okay, Kyle, where does the money come to actually fund and implement community schools?
Great question. So it depends where you come from, but there are some key sources that you can see the funding comes from, no matter where you come from. So one source is district-level funding. So some districts, just like they recognize the need for a principal in all their buildings, they recognize the need for a community school coordinator to lead these efforts. So there's a number of districts who fund it right out of the district budget. Some places are funded by the United Way and other foundations that want to spend their money that way. In other places, it's funded by federal grants, such as the Full Service Community School Grant, which $17.5 million is allocated to that. And we're, of course, trying to increase that allocation here at the NEA. And in some cases, it's funded by state legislation. And in other places, it's funded by city and county. So what's probably more important to think about here is the process of bringing stakeholders together on a unified vision for what they want to see happen in their schools and communities, and then bring all those stakeholders together to say, all right, so how do we pay for this? So when that process goes together really well, you see a braided or blended funding coming together from a coalition of stakeholders which have the means to take something like this to happen.
Okay, so what makes partners want to invest in public schools?
Great question. So I think that public schools tend to do a poor job of decoding for businesses, nonprofits, foundations of what their actual needs are. So Nike, who might be headquartered in your jurisdiction, might give you a billboard when actually you need shoes. Partners really love when you have deep data on the needs that are impact teaching and learning, and you share with them your understanding of their assets. Maybe it's a bank which has money, or maybe it's like a business which has mattresses, and that their assets can be critical to helping to achieve the vision of stakeholders. So, and some partners, it's their mission already, right? So sometimes, like, you have a nonprofit whose goal it is to support athletics. So partnering with a school, partnering with that nonprofit, is helping that nonprofit meet its mission. The same is true for hospitals, which are nonprofits, and their goals are to find patients that need the care. So by placing a clinic inside of a school building, helps them get closer to their clients. And we were talking earlier about Cincinnati, and you know, one really interesting thing is that the businesses and partners that are located inside the school, the optometrists, the dental, the mental health, all of them are profitable, because what they're doing is getting very close to their clients, and they've built a structure that allows for them to be profitable. The school pays for their space, but Medicaid and other forms of health insurance pay for all those other things. And you can argue that, like, those students and families should have been able to go 10 blocks away to receive some of those types of treatment, but in reality, it wasn't happening. So either you wish for the world as you want it to be, or you create the world that you want.
Okay. And I'm going to take a little station break here to identify us. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum with our topic being sustainable community schools. It's long been known that public education is underfunded. Our guests tonight with firsthand experience are Ann Pritchett, longtime teacher in Kansas City Public Schools, and Kyle Ceretti, who works for the National Education Association in Washington, D.C. So I just want to read a little excerpt off the Cincinnati Public Schools website, or it's really the Community Learning Center's website. Over the past 10 years, the Community Learning Center's model has drawn national attention for successfully engaging community partnerships in school buildings. CLCs offer health services, counseling, after-school programs, nutrition, parent-family engagement programs, and on and on. And the vision, the goal of Community Learning Centers is to support student achievement, revitalize neighborhoods, and maximize the community's return on its investment in public schools. How prevalent are community schools in the United States right now, Kyle?
There are about 5,000 to 7,500 community schools in the United States. So that's 5,000 to 7,500 out of 99,000 schools. So but one thing to know is that no one has been responsible for scaling the number of community schools in the United States. So right now there are organizations such as ours which are helping to lead that effort to scale community schools. But it's worth noting that these things don't scale themselves. What we find are a school here, a school there, five schools here, five schools there, and maybe a district that decides to take it on. But without a catalyst to work to scale this, it ends up not organically happening. So I think there's what you're doing today to raise awareness of community schools is very important. Superintendents who have community schools talking to each other is very important. Community leaders talking to each other is very important, because the need of what we know is that when children of poor parents and children of rich parents those kids are born with the same capacity to learn. And what we see are drastically different outcomes between those two different populations, and it's because we haven't built enough community schools, in my opinion.
From my tour there, I felt that everybody was saying that community schools are inherently more democratic. How is that so?
A lot of times, schools are designed in systems these days, right? And sometimes systems get used to the way things are, and over time, if 60, 70% of students aren't reading at grade level, you know that there's and everyone is trying their hardest to achieve it, you know that your strategy is slightly off, right? So I think what community schools do is work with all the stakeholders from the superintendent and the school board and the city council to the parents and the families and the community around to recalibrate what their vision is and how they're going to achieve their vision. And that takes patience and dedication, because in Cincinnati, when they went to go to one school or another school, sometimes they spent a year or 2 years trying to really understand what people want and need and what their assets are before they even got started on their community school, which they call community learning centers there. And it's that patience in understanding what schools need, which is brings you to the democracy, the greater democracy that you tend to see in community schools, because there's huge amounts of buy-in on various levels, and that leads to everyone working together to achieve that vision. And we already know that if you don't do that, you're not going to achieve the results that everyone wants you to achieve, but you're just not able to do it without a team effort.
Okay, and on the tour, one of the principal said this. He said that the role teachers' unions played was important in Cincinnati and also in Chicago. Have you observed this?
Yes, that's right. It's like, I think that is an evolving answer. I say if you talked to us 10 years ago, you wouldn't find teachers' unions as being a big part of the community school movement as you do today. But what happened 6 or so years ago were that the major teacher unions, which is the NEA and the AFT, got together with major community organizations. Think about the Journey for Justice, which G2 Brown leads, and others, that we got together and we said, we believe that no one's going to create the change unless that we really dig in. And we're one of the biggest organizations out there in education. I think we're the largest. So Chicago made community schools a priority, and they put it into contract negotiations. But that's a byproduct of conversations that happened 6 years ago when we decided that we didn't want our schools privatized, and because we thought that it was public schools is a public good, but we also were not happy with the inequity that we saw in schools, and we did a ton of research to understand what were strategies that could lead to the equity that we were talking about. And community schools, even though they're only in a small percentage of the overall school population, over and over and over have achieved that equity. And so now the National Education Association has passed a policy statement. We only have 8 policy statements out of our over 150-year history, and one of them is on community schools. And so our president, Lily, is hugely into community schools, and I know that the president of AFT, Randy Weingarten, is hugely into community schools, because community schools is about making it so teaching and learning can happen. And so that is a bread and butter issue. And so once we kind of pivoted from the traditional bread and butter, which is like pay and benefits and some working conditions, to an overall picture, a more broader picture of bread and butter, we were able to really get going. So you're starting to see NEA and AFT affiliates all across the country making this a priority in bargaining, in school board resolutions, in city, state, and federal. And we're one of the only organizations that has, I think, the resources together with our allies to help make it so maybe one day or we don't have to say community schools, how schools are.
Yes, and Randy was in Cincinnati the day I was there, and I was I was overwhelmed to see her there. It was very inspiring.
She came to my school when we were, when we first started. Randy came to our school, because we're an AFT local, and she came to visit, I think it was the first year that we had our programs up and running.
And we're nearing the end of our time here, so I want to ask a couple of final questions to both of you. When I went to Cincinnati, I heard a report compiled by AROS, the Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools. The report states that essentially public schools in urban areas are broke on purpose through the underfunding of IDEA and Title I, through the use of tax codes and corporate subsidies to drain the public coffer, and then you add into the privatization of public schools. All of these work to target and drain public education in Black and Brown communities. Can each of you comment on this report? Although none of us have read the entire report, I'd like to hear your comments about the report.
I've become really involved and politically since I retired 18 months ago. And one thing I observed as a teacher, and then I've seen it play out in so many other facets of life, is we have one political party who I'm convinced deliberately breaks government so they can then turn around and say, look, it's broken. And they always go back to that horrible story from Ronald Reagan about not wanting to go to the government if you want help, which is extremely offensive to people. That's their only source for help, many people. So I think that has a lot to do with this. And I don't think it's just education. You know, I live in Kansas, where we had a governor who for 8 years deliberately tried to break all of our services, and for no reason other than to say, well, they put the word taxes in there. We saved you money on taxes, which he really didn't. And look, it's broken. Why have this agency? It doesn't work. So, and I honestly believe that. I used to think that sounded like some kind of a conspiracy theory, but after all of my years teaching in an urban public school district, I'm convinced they break it on purpose.
And Kyle, you want to?
I would agree with that, and I think that that argument about a need for the government to provide these type of services becomes, and to do it more efficiently, becomes a convenient backdrop and excuse for lawmakers to then cut from education. But, mm-hmm. You know, there's two things here, right? One is funding, and that's a prerequisite. You need to be able to pay teachers a living wage, and you have to be able to provide.
KKFI is a non-commercial radio station. That means we receive financial support from our community marketing partners. These partners share information about their organizations or events while supporting KKFI's mission. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
This retired federal employee Bill Claus encouraging all my federal employee friends to please consider supporting KKFI during this year's combined federal campaign. That's CFC code 21994. Just a few dollars a week on payroll deductions won't mean much to you, but it'll mean big bucks to us at KKFI. So please consider supporting KKFI. That's agency code 21994.
Play KKFI. That's all you have to tell your smart speaker to get the news, views, and music you love. I remember the first time I told my smart speaker to play KKFI. Within seconds, I was listening to the stream. Pretty cool. KKFI, wherever you are.
I'm Kristen, and I'm a mother of a resilient 16-year-old daughter who's been educated in Cincinnati public schools since she was 3. And really, it's actually been exemplary. It's really, truly been a blessing. She has epilepsy, autism, developmental delays, and I've actually viewed it as that she's been lucky to have the dream team, just unbelievable, dedicated teachers and paraprofessionals. But it truthfully could have been different, because when she was five, she was moving out of a preschool disabilities class into the least restrictive setting, into a regular class. But in order to be successful in that regular class, she needed a paraprofessional. So that's what we had written into the IEP. But we had our principal changed. And when that school year began, they told me, they presented me with a paper and they said, look, you have to sign this. There's no longer funding for this paraprofessional. You just need to sign this so we can move on. And I happened to be a person who knew my rights, and I happened to work at a place that would give me the flexibility to go and schedule a meeting. And I happened, you know, I just happened to be able to have the time to do that and those sorts of things. And so I was able to say, wait, no, you can't do that. You know, this is critical for her. And it truly has been. And so it was restored, and I didn't sign the paper. And she had she's had a paraprofessional, and she has gone further than anyone ever thought was possible. Like, when our kids get the support they need, miracles happen.
Yes, it does.
And all of our kids matter. And what I want to say is that, like, what would have happened? And we need to make sure the funding, the IDEA funding, is fully there. I was shocked to learn we didn't have $13 million in 2015 that our kids should have had. And that for high school students today that are graduating, there's been $165 million that's been missing in the Cincinnati system. Because this hasn't been a fully funded mandate, it costs more to educate our kids with disabilities because they have challenges. It's recognized, it's known, it costs double what it cost other kids, and that's why the Individuals with Disability Education Act was passed. The fact that it hasn't been funded is unconscionable to the level it needs to be, because these resources are desperately needed. Our Cincinnati public schools struggle to make ends meet and to provide the support to all of our kids need. And right now, I've been at recent board meetings and they've been talking about how transportation for kids with special needs that are in high school might be threatened because they're just trying to figure out what to do. Our kids need that transportation. They have a lot going on, and the metro doesn't work for them in many ways. They should not. Our Cincinnati Public School Board should not be faced with those choices. We should have this funding in place. We need it for all kids.
Yes.
All kids matter.
Yes.
And when we have the money to provide the supports for all kids, they can thrive, and our community just prospers.
And this is Chris Mann closing out our program here. I just wanted to say one thing about the clip you just heard. That was from my trip to Cincinnati, and a young mother with a child with autism was talking about how the community school aided her daughter who had autism, and now she's thriving. I want to play a last clip about this report that I heard about when I was there, and that is the underfunding of IDEA and Title I and the use of tax codes and corporate subsidies to dismantle public education in Black and brown communities. The visit to the schools was wonderful. But the rally that was held after, where the speakers talked about their education coalition, was like the frosting on the cake. To see education activists in Cincinnati working together was beyond heartwarming to me. And I would like you to listen to Michelle Billingham as we close out the program. She also has a child with special needs in public schools, and I want it to sink in with us as we're listening here that the money that was supposed to go to Black and brown communities and special needs children never arrived in its entirety. And so please listen to this, and let's get together in Kansas City and strengthen our public schools. Technical difficulty. And I just want to talk about, I want to talk a little bit about the rally since our file didn't complete. We had Randy Weingarten there, the president of National AF American Federation of Teachers, and G2 Brown. So with that, I just wanted to point out to the Kansas City community, education community, that we can do better for our students and ourselves. Our whole community can become a sort of center with our schools. We can become more active and more engaging with each other and with our children. So thank you, and thank you for listening, and good night.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. It is the holiday season. There's Christmas and Hanukkah, and of course, there's New Year's. And in every holiday season, one of the things that's ubiquitous across the country is holiday parties. We have them with our coworkers, we have them with our friends, we have them with our families, and we have them sometimes with other parts of the family that can't get together with the first part of the The one thing that all these holiday celebrations have in common is many times along with the family and friends and laughing and food, there's also I thought I'd spend a little bit of time today talking about something that no one wants to talk about or think about, especially during the holiday seasons, but everybody should probably be reminded of, and that's DUIs, or driving under the influence of. In both Missouri and Kansas, the legal limit for alcohol consumption to be able to drive a vehicle is 0.08. Now, that is not a lot of alcohol, particularly if you're someone that drinks on any kind of a regular basis. It also depends a lot on your body composition and even what you've had to eat. However, it's still not a lot of alcohol. If you get pulled over and you are found to have a blood alcohol content of over 0.08, you are going to get a ticket for driving under the influence. You also are more than likely going to get arrested. And this is where the cost associated with driving under the influence of alcohol begins. At the very beginning, after you're arrested, your car probably is also going to be towed, so you will have to incur towing and storage fees. Also, you're going to be in jail. You're going to have to pay a bond in order to get out, and that is if you can pay a bond right then and not have to spend the night in jail and wait for a court date in order to get a bond the following day. Bonds usually, in this case, can range anywhere from $500 to a couple $1,000s. Money that you certainly probably want to spend on something other than bailing yourself out of jail and paying for your car that has been towed. The next expense comes when you actually have to do something about your ticket. Now, many people don't know this. There's two parts of a DUI case. The first part is the actual criminal part, which are the charges that you have to go to court for. The second part relates to your driver's license. This actually is taken care of in a manner that is called a civil manner, and so it's different than criminal cases, meaning in the driver's license part of the case, they don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you were drinking, rather just like more likely than not. If this happens, then you're going to lose your license for either 30 days or from between 30 days to up to a year. The situations that you can get a limited driver's license or an emergency driver's license to drive to places like school or work are very limited, and most people don't qualify for them. So now you also have an additional expense of the issue of your license being suspended. more than likely you're going to have to get an attorney to deal with this case. One thing, as I was talking about with the driver's license issue, you should get an attorney sooner rather than later. And this is because some of the rights that you have related to specifically the driver's license part of the case expire very quickly. If you're going to ask for a hearing related to whether or not your license should be suspended, you have to ask for that very quickly. You'll get a piece of paper that night that explains all those details, but sometimes in as little as 2 weeks. The lawyer's also going to cost attorney's fees. Then you're going to have to go to court. In all the courts in the city, you're going to have some type of probation. You might even have to do something called shock time, which means a certain amount of time in jail after your ticket. All the cases have some sort of fine or court cost. You'll also have to take usually classes that are going to cost money, and you may have to do community service, which you also have to pay for. If you negotiate something that isn't jail time, but rather something like in-house incarceration or a weekend intervention class, both of those things are separate charges. So, aside from being something that's extremely dangerous that could hurt or kill yourself or other people's, driving while intoxicated charges can end up costing a person thousands and thousands of dollars, nights in jail, loss of your license, and then having to maintain very expensive insurance afterwards in order to get your license back. All in all, taking a cab from anywhere you are in this city to anywhere else in this city is going to cost less money than having to deal with a DUI. So this holiday season, while you're celebrating, remember to celebrate responsibly. Remember to call a cab or call a Lyft or call an Uber or call your friend or stay where you are. But don't drive home drunk. This is Angie Williams from the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Be safe, Kansas City, and happy holidays.
Wise words from Angie there. Okay, so because it is the holidays, we don't have a calendar this week. We will have one hopefully next week. So that is the end of the show. Next week on the Harlan Labor Forum, Dana Frank will be talking with him about the Long Honduran Night, or maybe it's a her, not quite sure, the Long Honduran Night, and Barry Eidlin will be discussing labor and the class idea in the U.S. and Canada. I have been your engineer and host, Jen Zaman. Judy will be back next week.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.